and very early recent early experimental findings, then I'm going to go into two possible scenarios for this enigmatic ground state, quantum spinized in a non-magnetic singlet state, and then, of course, I'm going to talk about our neutron scattering measurements. If time permits, I'm going to talk a bit about sample variability, and then I'm going to conclude. So terbium titanate belongs to the family of rare earth titanates you just heard about. So you have the trivalent rare earth ions, are here, sitting on the corners of the tetrahedra here, so on the corners of this pyrochlore lattice, which is just this network of a tetrahedra. So this family displays a lot of exciting and rich physics. So in exotic ground states, such as classical spinizers, where we just heard this symposium, and a lot of substantial effort has recently been made on understanding ytterbium titanate, which is now labeled a quantum spinize, and also the ground state of erbium titanate has finally been tackled, and you find that ground state is selected by an order by a disorder mechanism. Gadolinium titanate has some complex low-temperature behavior and some partial ordering, which I'm not going to go into. And, well, terbium titanate, well, you see all of them are well understood except for the terbium titanate. So terbium titanate, we don't really know what we should call the ground state. Is it a spin liquid or quantum spin ice or what is it? So what's the story about terbium titanate? So you have icing anisotropy in this material, which constrains the terbium 3 plus, well, the moments, to point along the local 111 direction, so similar to dysprosium titanate. However, you have antiferromagnetic interactions. So classically, at a classical level, you would expect this material to order at a temperature of about 1K, which is not what you see. So you don't see any magnetic long-range order down to 50 millikelvin. So in experiments, this translates to these findings. So early work from about 15 years ago by Jason Gardner et al, they did MuSR measurements. And what they saw was the spins progressively freeze as you go to lower and lower temperature, but they don't, you know, enter a long-range ordered state. They still keep fluctuating, which you see here through this flat relaxation rate at low temperature. And they do this till 50 millikelvin or so. In powder neutron scattering data, you also don't see a long-range order, which you can tell by the absence of Bragg peaks. So up here, the only Bragg peaks you see are these structural peaks. However, what you see magnetically is this liquid-like diffuse scattering, which implies very short correlations. Actually, these correlations range over at most one single tetrahedron, so it's extremely short-ranged. So this was early work, like in 2001, and many times since then, this has been confirmed. And in single crystal measurements, what you see, this liquid-like peak actually translates into what we now call the so-called checkerboard pattern of the superdiffuse scattering. So here you have a map of reciprocal space, the HHL plane, which I come back to later on. And you see this kind of diffuse scattering features with highest intensities around 0.02. So this does not correspond to the classically expected, this diffuse scattering pattern does not correspond to the classically expected all-in, all-out state. And it doesn't correspond to what you would expect for a spin ice. So what's going on? The question is, how can we explain this ground state? So there have been two proposals for this. The first scenario is this quantum spin ice, and that has been put forward by Malavian and Jingra's group in 2007. But let me start by going back a little bit to the polar spin ice. So starting there, the holmium and the dysprosium titanate are very well described by that, and they find themselves back in here in this phase, in the two-in, two-out spinized phase of this diagram. And the terbium titanate, well, is more antiferromagnetic, so it sits over here and near the boundary of this all-in, all-out state, classically expected, and this two-in, two-out state. So it's very close to the boundary. Now, what's the difference between it? So the dipolar spinized model works for holmium titanate, and dysprosium, but not for terbium titanate. Well, the difference lies in the crystal field levels. So you can see here, you can see that the crystal field splitting between the ground state doublet and the first excited doublets is over an order of magnitude larger in holmium and dysprosium compared to the terbium. So when you project your Hamiltonian down on the doublet, the ground state here, this works well for dysprosium holmium, but not so well for terbium because it's only 15 Kelvin away. So now how do you get the quantum fluctuations in this material, or in this scenario here. So what you can imagine is having a third axis coming out of this diagram, which scales as the inverse of the crystal field splitting. So having that, you now allow the ions in these in this ground state level to virtually fluctuate between the ground state and the excited states. And therefore, you create more complex interactions, and you get into this so-called spin-ice, quantum spin-ice state. So that's one scenario. Another scenario is this non-magnetic singlet scenario, which has been put forward by a French group around Pierre Bonville, and has been, you know, advocated for them by a couple of years ago, for now. So this uses the fact that terbium is a non-Cramer's ion, so the ground state doublet is not guaranteed. So in fact, what you could imagine is having symmetry lowering of the crystal field environment and then splitting this doublet into two non-magnetic singlets. So, this cubic tetrahedral distortion has not been observed experimentally. However, what has been seen is there's some evidence for structural fluctuations, like a broadening of the peak shape, for example, at low temperatures, 300 millikelvin. And this could be taken as a possible precursor to a transition at much lower temperature. But again, this is still debated. So you can see the scenarios are quite distinct. So let's go to our neutron scattering measurements and what we see. So experimentally, what do? We have single crystals that we grow using the optical floating zone technique, which is standard for oxide materials, and that give us neutron-sized single crystals. Is about like a 3-centimeter long crystal. Then we take these samples to a neutron scattering facility. So the measurements that I'm presenting here are actually mostly done on the disk chopper spectrometer at NIST. So what you have here is you get your monochromate your neutrons, then you scatter with your known wavelength from your sample, which sits in here. And you scatter elastically and inelastically at the same time in these time of flight machines. And you collect all the neutrons that you get. And it's about 913 detectors. So you scatter them. It's like a very powerful technique. So what we did, we aligned the sample in a certain geometry so that we have the HHL scattering plane in the horizontal. And we can also apply a magnetic field. The lowest temperature that we reach in these experiments is 70 or 80 millikelvin. And we go, well, if you want the details, we have some certain energy resolutions. Okay, so let's start with our first measurements that are in a paper. So we look at reciprocal space maps. So we have the HH direction in this direction, the L direction and up here on the Y axis. And I have a series of these reciprocal space maps for different energy transfers. So here in the top left, we have the elastic scattering. So this is the static spin configuration that we are probing here. And what we see diffuse scattering at these so-called half-half-half positions, so at half-half, 1.5, 2.5, and so forth, in addition to these Bragg structural peaks. So you see the diffuse, it's much broader than the actually resolution-limited structural peaks. Then if you go up higher in energy, we recover the so-called checkerboard pattern, which is observed many, many times, that I've talked about earlier. And if we go up still higher, we actually catch the excitations to the excited doublet, the crystal field levels. So we are sensitive to those too. But what I'm focusing on is this part, because that's new. So what do we make of this? So you don't expect that. We haven't seen this. So. What we can do, or what we did actually, is we calculated the scattering intensity as a Q based on the fact that we have this phase shift of pi between the adjacent unit cells. So that's what you get. You get these half-half correlations. And we also included the width of the scattering. So we can determine in the correlation length from the isotropic width of this scattering. And that applies roughly a correlation over two unit cells. So we did that. And shown up here is a best fit result for fitting this data to nine of these Bragg peaks. And that actually is done on a cell containing 128 spins. That's why you have this kind of elongation here, because it's a finite calculation. And what this corresponds to now, it corresponds to real space spin arrangement of antiferromagnetically ordered spin-eyes. So in one unit cell, you can imagine that the spin-eyes rules are enforced. So you have a spin-eyes configuration. However, the spins are canted slightly away from 111, so they're tilted slightly by about 12 degrees. And that unit cell then, if you go to the adjacent unit cell, is antiferromagnetically aligned with that one. So all the spins in that gray cell here are reversed. So you have that, and you have that over, you know, a cell that contains about eight of these cells here. So this is quite similar what has been observed to the soft-ordered spin-eyes, like this arrangement of spins. There they observe a spin cant of 13 degrees. So let's have a look at terbium stannate, just as a short aside. So terbium stannate is a soft-ordered spin-eyes. It orders into this long-range spin-eyes phase below 0.87 Kelvin. And it also has with the structure, which is just similar to what we've seen on the last page. So in powder neutron diffraction, you see these additional Bragg peaks appear. And, well, below 0.87 Kelvin. But it's called soft because you still see in the MUSR relaxation rate, you still see some fluctuating state, even though you're in an ordered state. But that's just an aside. So terbium stannate and terbium titanate look quite similar on a first glance here, but they're not the same. So the crystal field levels are quite different too. Well, not quite, but different. OK, so what we did next then, we looked for the temperature dependence of these correlations. So up here in the left corner, I'm showing this same data now. This is from a different measurement, so it looks slightly different. But we have, again, here these half-half correlations. And that's at 80 millikelvin. And as we heat this to 400 millikelvin, these guys become really diffuse. And what we did then, we just measured the integrated intensities of all of these four peaks and averaged them and came up with the plot of integrated intensity versus temperature. So heating A is our first heating run. So you see this kind of order parameter-like behavior. So you have these half-half positions here, and all that remains down here at 400 millikelvin and higher is this diffuse checkerboard pattern. Then, well, due to experimental reasons, we had to warm up a bit and come back. So in our second, well, when we cooled back, we actually measured these three points. So we're substantially lower in intensity. And then heating back up, we get the red line, which is signified here in two of these data plots. So there's definitely history dependence to this. So it's kind of like a glassy or spin glass-like phase. But the important point to take away from this is once you scale the difference between, well, no peaks versus peaks, you scale this and put it on one plot, you get like an order parameter, and you see that the peaks disappear roughly around 275 to 300 millikelvin. What I'm also putting on here is a shaded area here, which is transitions from DC-AC susceptibility measurements. So there's a wide range of actually reported values for transitions in these susceptibility measurements, ranging from 150 millikelvin to 250 millikelvin. So here on the left, I'm showing a susceptibility data on polycrystalline material that we just got from Peter Schiffer's group. And what they see, actually, is that for really low frequencies, they see the peak roughly at around 200 millikelvin in chi prime. And as you increase the frequency, the peak shifts. It's typical for spin glass behavior. And this is 1 kilohertz, the lowest one, shifts to higher temperatures. And considering the fact that neutrons are high-frequency probe, it appears somewhat natural that our peaks, well, our transition is at sort of slightly higher temperature than what most people observe in these other measurements. Anyway, so we have this glassiness that we get from this. And we can also look at the spin dynamics. So far, we just probed the static spin correlations. So here, what I'm showing is high resolution data. So we have these two peaks in our field of view. And what we see here is that we actually, if you plot the intensity of these two black areas versus energy transfer, so it's imagining coming a third axis out of this top plot here. We see that there's a gap opening below 300 millikelvin. This is here, right? So we have the black line, which is our base temperature, and the red line is 275. So between 275 and 80 millikelvin, this gap opens. And in addition to that, we pile up, well, simultaneously, we pile up the intensity at the elastic line, which is, again, typical for a spinless freezing process. Notice it's on a logarithmic scale here. So we have these elastic peaks that correlate with the existence of the gap. And this gap exists over most of reciprocal space and has a value of 0.06 to 0.08 millielectron volts. So this is fairly small. Now, we can look at the dispersion. Is there dispersion to this excitation that we see at 0.8 and above millielectron volts? So what we did here, we took a much narrower window. And we find that, first of all, the excitations are weakly dispersive. And we can tell from this plot, so the magenta points are off peak, and the black ones are, again, on the peak. So you see it's really a very subtle feature. But there is some filling in of the gap here, so some softening, almost Goldstone-like, at these half-half-half positions. So one could think that maybe, you know, if this was a true long-range ordered state, that, you know, this might go soft at these half-half-half positions. All right. So we can also look at the field dependence of this material. So here we apply the field along the 1-1-0 direction. And so we start here again with these reciprocal space maps, OOL and HHO in this direction. So you see that these half-half-half peaks get suppressed as you increase a field. And at about a field of 0.075 Tesla, which is this bottom plot here, I would say that this is about background. So this is somewhere around here. And this destroys our half-half-half state. You might wonder about the additional features that you see here at higher fields, and even at zero field. You get these star-like or rod-like features along certain directions that have been observed in quantum spin ice and other materials. And these are signs of anisotropic exchange. So this is another route, like tackling the Hamiltonian with anisotropic exchange tensors and working in that to figure it out. But anyway, so we are not there yet, okay? So now this is another paper that just came out recently. And here they apply the field along the 1-1-1 direction and did AC susceptibility measurements. So this is from Florida Highfield Lab. So did AC susceptibility measurements. And here we show that they have temperature versus field here, field on a logarithmic scale. So what they observe is actually they call this phase here, so quantum spin ice, and this Kagome ice phase. Our points lie here on the purple, you know, circles. And there we see a phase transition at about 70 millikelvin, say. Or is it 70? Probably, no, not quite. 60, right? It's hard to see from here. So they see a transition again. It's slightly lower field than we do. But again, you know, this is a slightly different direction, so this might change things a bit. But it's roughly consistent with what we see. So our half-half-half short-range order is pretty much gone by this field. So you might think about that as well. Okay, so do I have time? Apparently I do have time. 5 minutes, okay, perfect. So I get to the sample variability. So as we've heard from Jan just about the dysprosium titanate, there's some issues of stuffing. So this is another recent paper coming out roughly the same time that we did, Kadawaki's group. And they did polycrystalline, like they did measurements of specific heat on polycrystalline samples. And what they actually see is some long-range order. So they see some sign of long-range order, like a sharp peak, for some slightly stuffed terbium titanate. So a slight level of the non-stoichiometry leads this to this peak here. If you think on the other side, you really suppress the peak fairly quickly. So they say that this is sort of like their phase diagram. They come up with a temperature versus composition phase diagram. And they see that this is actually, if you can't actually have a long-range ordered state, and you can also have a true liquid here. So this is only a tiny level. It's like 0.5% of dilution. And it has this huge effect on the ground state. So actually what they also see here is some neutron scattering data on powders, and they also see signs of this half-half-half peak. So now a big question is, where is our sample in this phase diagram? And another big question actually is, what we see here is like, is this, well, it's probably the main question. It's like our half-half-half short-range order, is this due to some non-stoichiometry, and you get this spin glassy state, or do you get this order because, let me rephrase that, so do you get this order because you have this order, but because you have this non-stoichiometry in the sample and you just get the spin glass? So in fact, you would have a true spin liquid and you only get this because you have this order, or is our short range order a way to get to the true ground state for the system? So this is kind of a main question that, you know, we need to tackle. So this is going to be one route to do this, by maybe trying to grow samples that are slightly off in stoichiometry. So with that, let me conclude. It was a bit fast again. So we do see these short-range antifermionic spinized correlation extending over roughly 2U conventional yield cells at 70 millikelvin. We can describe this as an ordered local two-in, two-out spinized structure with a spin canting. These correlations disappear upon heating to 300 millikelvin. They appear to be glassy in nature. The elastic scattering is separated by a gap from this low-lying inelastic magnetic scattering, which extends over most of the Brillouin zone. And this gap appears to go soft at the half-half positions. The influence of the magnetic field is such that it destroys the order by very small fields. And, well, we just talked about the sample variability, so that might be an issue to investigate in the future. Thank you.
Time for questions. Questions or comments?
Yes.
So, do you have an understanding of the reason for the tilting of the spins away from the Ising axis? Is there
a
microscopic?
Not necessarily. So, the fact is that this is actually what's coming out of the best fit. So we are not sensitive to the other two spin directions. So we just see one direction. So just along the local Z axis that we see this canting. The other
does
two,
that affect the peak intensities or the shape of the
that's
peaks?
That's the peak intensities. So it's mainly integrating over these guys and then fitting this to whatever spin canting we allow. Mm-hmm. So, and then this is like a, well, if you allow the spin canting, I cannot tell the difference between having all three local axes tilted slightly away from the Ising or just having two axes tilted and two axes exactly along 111 and one axis slightly tilted. So this seems to be like the best fit here. So there would be a difference between this and the real spinies. So if you have a classic, well, not the classical, but if you have a spinies with all in all that, two in, two out, exactly along 111, this doesn't give as good a fit as this one does.
Okay, more questions?
Well, just a comment on the same question, and that is that we've also done crystal field measurements, and so the wave functions associated with the ground state doublet and the excited state doublet in terbium titanate do not correspond to a single MJ value. There's sizable contributions to more than one MJ value. So it's a little bit different from, say, the holmium and dysprosium titanate, where the Ising moment is basically the full saturated moment pointing either directly or in or out. Here it's more more of a superposition of two of those. And I suspect that's what gives rise to the softness.
Any other questions?
Since we are all getting soft about this thing here, let me just say that so it's simple to understand in a simple model of the crystal field, even dipolar interactions or exchange here, is that the admixing between the crystal field and mix the state, and if you then reconstruct an effective model at low energy, you find that you don't no longer have a perfectly Ising model, but you have an Ising model, and like Radu was talking about this morning, you get a new effective perpendicular G tensor, so the spins can actually have a expectation value transverse to their local z direction. So it comes from the fact that the interactions are large enough to admix the two lower crystal field states.
Any more questions? OK, if not, let's thank Katarina for a great talk.
Thank you.